You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. The last time I spoke with Celeste Ng was for her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, which won critical acclaim and in fact was featured in one of the first episodes of Intersections Radio. And last month she published her second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, and I suspect it will surpass the accolades of the first one. Little Fires Everywhere tells the story of two families in Shaker Heights, a suburb outside of Cleveland, and these two families are unexpectedly connected. And this unexpected connection brings the families together and eventually tears the community apart when morals are tested and mothers find and lose children and Shaker Heights and all of its rules and order are undone in the process. Celeste Ng joins me in studio today. This is Intersections Radio. Celeste Ng, welcome back to Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book was kind of a jaw dropper in some ways, and obviously a page turner. Let's back up and talk a little bit about you and Shaker Heights, where you grew up, actually. So Shaker Heights is the backdrop of the story. Talk about your life growing up there.
So Shaker Heights is a suburb on the east side of Cleveland, and I moved there just before I turned 10, and I lived there until I went off to college and came back for summer vacations and things like that. And it was a great place to grow up. I loved growing up there. It's known for being very racially integrated, which is one of the reasons my parents moved there, for being very progressive and for being very idyllic. And it actually is all three of those things. But it's also a very rule-oriented society. There used to be a lot of rules about what colors you could paint your house so that the houses on the street would not clash with each other.
Okay, but let's say, I mean, that's the rules of Shaker Heights and not like a housing association rule.
No,
that's what's bizarre.
It's the city, yeah, and it's not true anymore. Now you can do what you like.
But oh, okay.
They're very concerned with sort of appearance and with keeping the neighborhood looking sort of idyllic, as I said. Shaker Heights is actually one of the first planned communities in the United States. It was incorporated in 1912, and they really planned out everything from the layout of the roads to what the houses could look like to all kinds of different sort of rules to try and make this little pocket of paradise on earth as they saw it. And so I grew up in Shaker Heights in the 90s, which is the era that the book is set in, thinking that that was normal and that that was just sort of how neighborhoods were. This is how the world worked. And it wasn't until I moved away that I realized a lot of the things about Shaker Heights that are unusual, both for good and for less good, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, the book takes place in the 90s, and I personally really appreciated the 90s nostalgia, you know, for better or for worse. But it was like, oh, this is just like the high school years. You know? And as I mentioned earlier, Shaker Heights is as much a character as a backdrop to the story, you know, the community of rules and order. To me, when I was reading this, it kind of felt like you were saying it's a planned community, and it felt like it believed it could really be the experiment that America is trying to be, you know, living in a multiracial, multicultural society with respect for everyone, equality for everyone, except, well, the other thing about it taking place in the 90s is that there was this notion of color blindness. Maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, in the 90s when I was growing up there, what I remember about how you expressed your racial awareness was to say, I don't see color, and to pretend that race didn't exist. Shaker Heights has actually always had race at the front of the public conversation since the 1950s. In the 50s, there was a bomb planted at the house of a black lawyer who was living in the area, and the community kind of came together. This was a turning point, and they decided that they were going to really actively act to integrate the community. And since then, race has been a big topic of discussion. There's actually a race relations group at the high school. High school students go and work with fifth and sixth graders, and every fifth and sixth grader gets sort of like a 2 or 3 day like racial training seminar, essentially, from these high schoolers. They sit in small groups and they talk about what does prejudice mean? What does discrimination mean? How do we fight peer pressure? How do we fight these things? How do you respond when you have those things? These are all, again, the things that I thought were normal until I went to college, and people said, you had a race relations group at your high school.
That's unheard of.
And what often happened was that the fifth and sixth graders would remember their experience and get up to the high school and then join the student group on race relations, which is what it was called. It was one of the kind of cool clubs to be in. And so I was in the student group in race relations. I didn't get in my first year, but I got to go in at my sophomore year.
So it was so popular that it was like a wait list to get in.
Yeah. And it wasn't even a wait list. You didn't exactly audition, but you kind of went in and you talked in meetings and they wanted to see how you could facilitate a discussion. They really could pick who they were taking, and they were trying to get a lot of diversity in the group. So the thing about Shaker Heights is that it is really based on these sort of ideals, that we can create a perfect community. We can, promote racial equality, all of those things. It's really kind of baked into the community. And of course, the problem is that the real world is very messy. And so even though we're trying to do all those things, the community still has the same blind spots that I think we're struggling with as a country today.
Just the way you're describing this and reading this book and knowing that you were from Shaker Heights, it kind of felt like it was like a very intimate but honest love letter to Shaker Heights. You know, it was because you did have to talk about the realities of why this doesn't work.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you see it as a love letter, because I do too. I mean, I loved growing up there, and I still really love the community, and there's so much about it I think that's really admirable. I think that it's a little bit like writing about a relative where, you know them really well. You want to show all of the good things about them, but you also feel that you need to acknowledge the things that they aren't as good at. I think Shaker Heights actually has a pretty clear-eyed view of itself. They want to be exemplary, and yet they know also that there are ways in which they are still working towards equality, inclusion, on class differences, all of those things. And so I hope that the people who read it do see it as, like you said, as a love letter.
Well, now I'm kind of curious. I know the book has only been out for just a few weeks now. So have you had any community response?
One thing that I can say is that by coincidence, there's been someone from Shaker Heights at pretty much every event that I've done so far. A few of them are people that I know and who've come because they knew me, but many of them are just people who I have no connection with, and they saw Shaker Heights and they come and they say, my mom grew up in Shaker Heights, or I used to live there, or I went to school there, or whatever. And most of them say, this is kind of dead on. And I really appreciate that. That means a lot. And so I hope that the people who are still living there also sort of see it that way.
Sure. I also wanted to ask you what it was like to do the research for this book, because you deep dive into the community and into these characters. What was it like to dig into your hometown, for which you did enjoy growing up there?
It was really fun, actually. Since I set the book in the 90s when I was in high school and I was writing about a bunch of high schoolers, in part, I got to send them to a lot of the places that I loved. And so I had fun nostalgia research, looking through old yearbooks and things like that and pulling on memories. And then I talked to the local history librarian at the Shaker Heights Library, who was incredibly helpful. And she was able to give me newspapers from the time, school newspapers from the exact years that I was looking at, the community news magazine. And I also did a really, really deep dive into the history of the Shakers, who were the religious community that owned the land before Shaker Heights was founded. Shaker Heights was named after them, even though there weren't any Shakers living in Shaker Heights. And I learned way more about the Shakers than any person actually really needs to know. But it was fascinating to see both sort of what the founders of the town and, you know, sort of the early residents of the town envisioned for the city, to compare that to the city that I grew up in. And then also to look back at who had owned the land before them. The Shakers were a utopian community. And to sort of see just how deep that kind of idealism really ran. It's almost sort of leached into the soil.
That's really interesting. And it comes out in these characters. Let's get to the story. The characters include the Richardsons, who are a well-to-do family of six, and they rent out a house to the Warrens, who are Mia, a single mother, and Pearl, her teenage daughter. And these two families are diametrically opposite in this very planned and rural-oriented Shaker Heights city. So there are a lot of issues that come up, and so there's an issue of motherhood and how motherhood is created, how one becomes a mother, and how it's maintained and built and torn and judged and rebuilt. And Yeah, it was surprising because I actually tried to avoid reading the blurbs and all of the press material that came with this before reading the story. So then there's this very prominent storyline of what is considered a fit mother, both by just our societal norms as well as in this community. And talk about how that came about, how that plot line came about.
Yeah, so I had developed these two families, the Richardsons, who are sort of the living embodiment of sort of the Shaker Heights ethos, that they're very progressive, they're very well-meaning, they're kind of affluent, and they also have their own blind spots. They're very stable, they've been in the community for several generations. And this mother-daughter pair, Mia, who is sort of the polar opposite, she's a single mother, she's an artist, so she doesn't have sort of a reputable, stable career. They move around a lot, and mm-hmm. they really own almost nothing. They basically just take all of their belongings with them in the car, and that's all they have. And as I sort of put these two families together and kind of thought about the ways that they would get entangled, the ways that they would interact with each other, and the differences that they would find, I realized that what I was writing a lot about was sort of class and about race and also about motherhood, this issue of sort of mothering and...
it's really entangled in class and race and everything.
Exactly. I mean, all of these things sort of overlap with each other, which makes it a perfect topic for this show. And a storyline of the adoption where there is an affluent white family from Shaker Heights, friends of the Richardsons, who want to adopt a Chinese-American baby that's been left at a fire station. They've been raising her since she was left, so it's been most of her life so mm-hmm. far. She's almost a year old. And the birth mother comes in and wants her back. And the custody battle that ensues sort of divides the community and also divides Mia Warren, the single mom from out of town, and Mrs. Richardson, the mother who lives there. That's sort of the flashpoint between them. And the case of the adoption just kind of pulled together all of those threads about race, about class, about sort of what we expect mothers to be like, and the ways that we judge mothers for the things that they do or they don't do, mm-hmm. All of that is something that I keep finding myself drawn to. And so that that adoption case sort of acted as, if you pardon the pun, the sort of spark that kind of lit all of those different fuses.
That lit all of the little fires everywhere. One of the major issues that we unfortunately still talk about is who deserves to be a mother. That is to say, who deserves to have a child, to keep a child. And as a mother, you are not allowed to make one mistake. You are not allowed to have any sort of dip in what is expected of you. I mean, more than I think other parents and relatives and caretakers and guardians.
I think it's much more, we're much tougher on mothers.
Mothers
are tougher on mothers. Exactly. There's this sort of standard, I think, that the mothers have to basically be perfect and do everything, and yet also at the same time are criticized by everyone, including themselves, about every aspect of motherhood. Did you have your children too early? Did you have your children too late? Maybe mm-hmm. you had too many children. Maybe you've been trying too long and it's because you're working too hard and you haven't put enough priority on that. If you decide to adopt, then you're not having your own biological children. Mm-hmm. If you decide that you're going to do in vitro fertilization, why are you doing such an invasive thing when there are children that need homes? You basically have lost from the beginning.
Yeah.
I think in
your
the
body
way
is
that,
not yours.
And I think then even after you have the child, I think mothers more than anybody are scrutinized for every decision they make, whether they decide to work, whether they decide to go back, how long they decide to take off, how they decide to feed their children. This area is just so rife with judgment. And that's one of the questions of the book, which is sort of what happens to a mother of any kind, adoptive, biological, chosen mother, when they can't give you all of the things that you need. There's a question raised in the adoption storyline about, who's a fit mother and who gets to make a mistake? If you've made a mistake, are you done? Are there no do-overs, as a different radio interviewer asked me? And the problem is that those standards are usually applied really unevenly. And this is where mm-hmm. we get into class and we get into race.
Right.
That the actions of mothers who are less privileged we weigh those really heavily. We're kind of a one strike and you're out often. And it's hard not to think about what's lost if we're applying that kind of standard to motherhood.
Right. Like you were saying, this is an immigrant mother.
Yes.
Who ends up leaving her child because she has really hit rock bottom for a number of reasons that I think many of us would have. And a lot of it just had to do with access to money and resources.
Exactly. That she's a single mom, and she's working a blue-collar job as a waitress. She's a new immigrant, and so she kind of doesn't know about what support systems there are. And, you know, the support systems that are there are not necessarily adequate either. And
she couldn't afford the very basics, like diapers and formula for
exactly.
a child.
Exactly. And so she's criticized for not providing those things. And it's true. You know, those are things that you do need. But at the same time, the question is really if she's working this kind of job and that's all that they're paying her and there's no support network for her, is it fair to punish her? Is there a better way than by giving her child to another family? It's really complicated, and one of the things I wanted to do in the novel really was to just kind of peel back how complicated it is, because I don't think there are easy answers.
No, and that brings me to my next point, which is that this book has really extreme characters. I mean, just within the Richardsons and the Warrens, who are the two main families, but also other characters who come in. Everybody is sort of on extremes. But because you do this deep dive into the characters, we see their complexity and we see their humanity and their flaws, and we see the full history of how everyone got to where they are. This must have been a process for you. Talk about it.
It was a process. I mean, one of the things that was really important to me was that there not be a villain in the book. And the flip side, of course, that there not be a clear hero. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anybody here who doesn't have a little bit of dirt on their hands. And there's also nobody in here who's just sort of the mustache twirler and just this force of malevolence. I have a 7-year-old son at home, and I'm learning that at his age, they're really interested in this idea of who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. And one of the things that we talk about is that bad guys often don't think that they're bad guys. Bad guys often think that they're doing the right thing. They think they're acting for good.
They think they're the heroes.
Exactly. And that's a really complicated idea for a kid to get his head around. It's a complicated idea for adults to get their head around, too. But I wanted each of the characters to be complex enough that you would at least understand why they were doing the things they were doing. Even if you didn't agree, even if you didn't like them, even if you think that you would never do that, it was really important for me, for example, to make sure that people saw the adoptive parents also as sympathetic figures who do have a real claim on this baby. You know, they've been taking care of her since she was about a month old. They're the ones who have been doing the day-to-day work of mothering, right? At the same time, also to sort of look at the biological mother's ties beyond just saying, well, she's biologically hers, sort of what led her up to giving up her baby. And the same was true for all of those characters. I belong to a writer's group in Boston, and when I showed them early pages of the novel, they would really helpfully call me on it and say, I feel like the narrative is pushing us to be really sympathetic to this character over this character. And that was a time where I would have to say, okay, I have to go back and dig a little bit deeper, make it a little bit more complicated so that we can just see that all of these characters are making difficult choices and doing the best that they can.
We do see that pretty equally dealt out with everybody. We talked a little bit about this with the custody battle in the story. I mean, I obviously have to bring up the issue of birthright cultural heritage. It's what turns this whole element of Shaker Heights, believing that they are so equal and so colorblind, it turns it on its head. You know, you and I come from immigrant parents. How do you feel about that notion in contemporary times as compared to in the 90s?
It's complicated. I mean, like you said, you know, I'm the child of immigrants. My parents came from Hong Kong, and there's already enough sort of space between me and my, you know, quote unquote, like birth culture. Mm-hmm. I don't speak Cantonese, which is my family's dialect. I'm pretty familiar with the food, but I don't, you know, I don't have a lot of other cultural ties. I don't know a lot of the sort of rituals and traditions and all of those things. And with a young child, I'm thinking a lot about what I can pass on to him and in what ways this kind of heritage can seem meaningful to him. I don't have the answers to that yet, but I do know that I want it to be a part of his life. You know, I want it to be something that he at least has access to if he chooses to do that. And I think in the 90s, you know, that was really a time where we talked a lot about assimilation. And there was sort of this idea that your culture was sort of like it was like a piece of clothing that you could kind of take off. And then if you wanted to, maybe you could put it back on later. But the idea that, you know, what was really important first and foremost was sort of you fitting into the place that you were in. That was how I remember the discussion going at the
time. Me too.
And that's an issue that we're thinking about in a slightly more complicated way now. We're just saying, what might be lost if you don't have that? And I think the pendulum maybe has swung back a little way. I feel like there's an interest now in a lot of people about sort of reclaiming different parts of their culture. And thinking about the genetic testing that is really popular now. It's really cheap, but it's also really, people are really interested to sort of find out, where did I come from biologically? And that tells them something about themselves, or it changes how they see themselves. And, you know, we have that feeling that, you know, the roots that you came from and your biology and your, you know, your actual DNA has some bearing on who you are, right? It's not all just nurture. There is nature in there. And so I don't know really where the discussion is headed from here. But at the time, I feel like there was so much emphasis that was placed on, you know, kind of assimilation, like I said, about, you know, sort of this is all about nurture. This is all about, you know, what's best for the child. And now we're realizing that there's always going to be a trade-off, that you're going to lose something. As the lawyer says, you know, he's asking, you know, do you have any books that feature Asian characters? Do you have any dolls that look anything like this child? Are they all blonde and blue-eyed? You know, do you have any connection to Chinese culture that you'll be able to give her, you know, as she gets older, that will, you know, allow her access to that part of the identity? And those are hard questions.
They are. And, you know, it has me thinking, we both have children and we both value our birthright cultures. For me, I feel sometimes like it's this burden. I represent my entire community. Are you kidding me? I cannot represent complex
billion people. Yeah.
But it, because of the communities that we're in, we end up being the 1 billion representation.
That's sort of
it's
it. I mean,
a burden.
You end up being sort of the touchstone, you know, like it or not, and for better or for worse. And I feel like maybe the best that we can do is hope to be sort of like a window or a door through which that culture can be accessed, because it's going to be different things to everybody. I mean, I said both of my parents came from Hong Kong, which is true, but my dad was born in mainland China in a small rural village, and my mom was born and raised in Hong Kong, and my father came over to Hong Kong a little bit later when he was an adolescent. And to an outsider, you know, I think a non-Chinese person, you go, oh, you're both Cantonese speakers. You're both, you know, from the same region. You both grew up in Hong Kong.
Easy.
Right. The way that they look at the world is incredibly different. You know, Hong Kong being a British colony, my mom has a certain amount of British influence in her and in her perspective. And the novel that I wrote took place in Cleveland. And there's a huge divide between the west side of Cleveland and the east side of Cleveland. Nobody crosses over from one side to another. And you're like, this is one city in Ohio, and we're just talking about, it's not even divided by, you know, like a chasm. It's, it's, you know, you think about that, that's kind of a human thing, that we're going to always be sort of subdividing ourselves into smaller categories. So to go back to your question, the idea that, you know, one person can represent a culture as if that culture is a monolithic thing is problematic. But I think that, I think that we are starting to be more aware of just the ways in which you can say, like, that is a world that you can enter, right? There are lots of things in it, you know, that's a building with many rooms. And I know about one of them, but you should be able to go to that room.
Right.
That question of representation, I feel like, has become more at the front of our conversation now.
Well, thank goodness. It was a little rough in the 90s.
It was. My mother, when I was a child, was always trying to find me an Asian baby doll and couldn't find one. And the first Asian doll that I got was from the American Girl Company. And I think about 1995, they made this line of dolls for the first time where they had lots of different hair colors and lots of different eye colors.
I remember that.
You could choose the one that kind of looked the most like you. And there was one Asian doll. And my mom bought it for me, even though, you know, I was 15, because it was really important, I think, for her and for me to have it. And I still own that doll. And I took my son to the toy store when he was about 2, and he gravitated toward this Asian boy baby doll. And my son is mixed race. He's part Asian and part white. And I thought, that's a little progress. There is such a thing as a boy baby doll and an Asian boy baby doll.
Yeah.
So we bought the doll. We took him home. It is a very slow process, but I feel like we are starting to recognize that there is value in having a little bit more representation.
Celeste Ng, thank you so much for joining me this time in person on Intersections Radio.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was my guest, Celeste Ng. The book is Little Fires Everywhere, and it's out now where books are sold. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.